Welcome to Sojourner Truth, and thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, today. A one-hour special with filmmaker and former Earth First activist, Daryl Cherney. He was one of the survivors, along with Earth First activist Judy Barry, who survived a bomb attack of their car in Oakland, California in 1990. They were then accused of bombing themselves. Meanwhile, no attempt was made to find the perpetrator, who is still at large today. A recent movie, Who Bombed Judy Barry, was recently released. The film chronicles their story with archival footage that includes moving testimony from the late Judy Barry. We live in a global world. We are all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Today, a one-hour special with filmmaker and Earth First activist Daryl Cherney. He is the producer of the documentary film Who Bombed Judy Barry. He was one of the survivors, along with Judy Barry, of a bomb attack on their car in Oakland, California in 1990. They were then accused by law enforcement of bombing themselves. Meanwhile, no attempt was made to find the perpetrator, who is still at large. The film chronicles their struggle for justice with moving testimony from the late Judy Barry. And here in studio with me, I would like to welcome Daryl Cherney. Daryl, thank you so very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Margaret.
All righty. A bit about Daryl Cherney, who is the producer on this film. He hails from New York City, where he was born and was a child actor. And he has been an activist, a singer, songwriter, and organizer in Humboldt, California on environmental issues. He helped to spearhead the successful campaign to protect the Headwaters Forest, now a national preserve in Northern California. He was also a creator of Environmentally Sound Promotions, a nonprofit, and he's produced albums of his original songs dedicated to environmental protection. He's organized, along with Judy Barry, the late Judy Barry, I should say, hundreds of rallies and events, and with national press coverage on behalf of forest protection and also civil rights. He broke the story on Julia Butterfly. A lot of people might remember her as the tree sitter that stayed in the tree for, I think, about 2 years, wasn't it?
Two full years.
And his work has appeared on Donahue, Primetime, The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and CNN. He also has done his share of lobbying, and along with Judy Barry, helped to create the Redwood Summer, the famous Redwood Summer campaign in 1990. And also, they were successful in creating alliance between workers and environmentalists. So, Daryl Cherney, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and you're actually here in town because the film played in Los Angeles at the Lemley Theater, had a two-day run, and I know you're hoping that more Angelenos will be able to see it and it will return to L.A.
As a matter of fact, we are playing at the Awareness Fest. People can look that up on the internet, the weekend of May 3rd through 5th or 6th.
Very good. I actually wanted, because the film, they're peppered with you and your songs singing, and sometimes you and Judy singing, and I wanted to go to one of those songs right now to start off our discussion.
Chainsaws killing the trees, disrupting everything that lives in peace. Our animal friends are on the run, but there's nowhere to go when the job is done. How can we stand by while this all takes place? We've got to stop this inhuman race. No compromise.
All righty. No compromise in the defense of Mother Earth. Earth first. So, Daryl Cherney, I wanted you to give us a sense of how you got involved in this movement. I mean, clearly you have a long-term passion for this work, and how and why you got involved with Earth First.
It probably began when I took a cross-country trip with my parents when I was 14 years old and saw the Redwoods for the first time and just fell in love with them and pledged that I would someday move back. And 15 years later, when I was 29, almost 30 years old, I came back to California. Immediately learned that the Redwoods were being clear-cut, and in particular a corporate takeover company from Houston, Texas, Maxam Corporation, had taken over the world's largest holder of ancient redwoods, Pacific Lumber Company, and had eventually gone on to triple the logging of those incredible trees, you know, 300 feet tall, 15 feet wide, 15 and 2,000 years of age. And I couldn't believe it. And so I immediately set out to begin a campaign with my associate, Greg King.
And what year was this?
That was in 1985.
Okay.
So when I arrived in Humboldt County in 1985, that takeover had just taken place. And I knew I had to do something. I had actually come to California specifically to engage in political activism as well as to learn how to live off the land. I had grew up in New York City. I felt that it was not exactly a habitable place for myself as a human being anymore, and I wanted to live amidst nature. So when I got to nature, I found that it was being destroyed. And with my passion for politics, we started an Earth First chapter in Humboldt County, California.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so tell us, for the younger environmentalists and activists who are listening right now, about what else was happening in the environmental movement and along the West Coast at the time, because there was really quite a lot of activity happening, Earth First and others.
Yes. Well, 1985, 1986, really the forest protection movement was just beginning to grasp the meaning of the Forest Protection Act, which had been passed by the California State Legislature a few years earlier, enabling lawsuits to take place to stop clear cutting, to stop the killing of endangered species. There were many issues along the way. There was nuclear power plant issues even in Humboldt County. Humboldt Nuke had been shut down not that long ago. But the issues, particularly involving streams and the salmon, which also involve clear cutting because the trees keep those streams cool for the salmon, was also very much in the minds of people. Pesticides and herbicides were an issue. People spray the trees to get rid of the oaks and the madrones just so the Douglas fir and the redwoods could grow. And, of course, those pesticides affect the animals and the earth itself, poisoning us all eventually.
Right. And I'm wondering, not to link the two, because I know they're two separate organizations with Earth First and the Earth Liberation Front, but I'm wondering some of what we'll talk about a little later in the film, some of the tactics and strategies, because there were also Earth First activists in Oregon and, you know, putting blockades on the roads to stop the loggers and that sort of thing. So was this after that period of time, or was it just within that window of time that you had all of this activism happening basically along the Pacific coast?
Well, the Earth Liberation Front came quite a bit later, but just to put things in perspective, when Earth First was founded in 1981, it used the industrial workers of the world as a model. The IWW, also affectionately known as the Wobblies, the industrial workers, were the first union to organize people of color, women, and in particular, industrial workers as a whole, people who worked in the factories, really poor people. And the IWW back in 1905 to 1920 in their heydays embraced sabotage at the workplace. So in a sense, sabotage, destruction of equipment really emanated out of the labor movement and frankly is still in the labor movement today.
Right. And way before the labor the labor movement, I'm sure. I actually did a show on the history of occupations, and one of the first occupations that we know about was in ancient Egypt, where people took over the temples because they weren't getting the grain that the pharaohs promised them. So a lot of these tactics have been tried and true in different ways and with using different technology.
It is amazing how the issues in some ways haven't really changed that much in the last 6,000 years. But moving forward to Earth First, yeah. I think the next step in the environmental movement was really Greenpeace, who engaged in very serious direct action, putting their bodies in boats in front of nuclear blasts, trying to stop the slaughter of seals. And then out of that, putting your body on the line thing came Earth First, which was sort of a blend between the industrial workers of the world and Greenpeace. But Earth First had no structure. It was a movement, not an organization. We had and have no members. So for the most part, to be an Earth Firster, just to put the
– So you didn't have a CEO.
No CEO, not at all. No board of directors. It's kind of – you get things done a lot quicker that way.
Yeah.
And that appealed to me quite a bit because I am a bit of a free spirit, and I can be a lone wolf as well as a group person, and I like the flexibility of that. So – Earth First, the principles of Earth First were, one, direct action. You have to take some kind of action. There are no couch potato Earth Firsters. You can't pay your money and just say, I'm an Earth Firster. The second thing is no compromise in defense of Mother Earth. We don't believe that the Earth is ours to compromise. You know, you can give many other examples. How much of the ozone layer is it our right to compromise? How much of the Earth's destruction is it our right to compromise? And the third principle of Earth First is biocentrism, that we see humanity as sharing the planet with all the other species on it. We're not the only one, and so we see the ecosystem as having a right to be here for its own sake.
You mentioned some of the earlier tactics of Earth First, and I remember watching a film on ELF, the Earth Liberation Front, If a Tree Falls Again, a very, very interesting film, mm-hmm. I must say, that took steps a bit further than Earth First was prepared to do. But they did talk about sabotaging and tree spiking and that sort of thing. And I'd like to discuss that a little bit now. And there's a piece of music from the film that talks about I'm a tree spiker. Mm-hmm. Let's hear that now.
But after a few years it dawned upon me, when they built them damn roads and they cut all the trees, that I was a fool, too blind to see. Now I'm a tree spiker, have pity on me. I've been a tree spiker for many a year. I spend all my money on tree spikes and beer. I go down to the valley where the tall timber grows.
All righty. I'm a tree spiker. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and our guest is Daryl Cherney. He is the producer of the film Who Bombed Judy Barry, but also was personally involved because he was in the car in 1990 when it was bombed, and he was injured and then accused of basically bombing himself and that sort of thing. He is here in studio with us, and we're discussing a bit the movement, the Earth First movement, and his involvement and his beginning early activism as an environmentalist. And Daryl, I was interested in playing that song because, as I mentioned before, the song, we saw in the film about the Earth Liberation Front, some of the people in Oregon, I think also with Earth First, this was before ELF, yes, that they were involved in various kinds of sabotage to stop the logging, some of which very effective, I might add, and
yes,
very sophisticated, you know, building barriers on the roads and tree spiking and that sort of thing. But for people who are not familiar with tree spiking, and also why then your group Earth First took a position against it and against doing it, being involved in it.
Well, when I first got involved with Earth First, and probably even to this day, Earth First has provided a forum for discussing sabotage in defense of the environment. And in my time in the late 80s and right through the 90s, I would say there was probably a lot more talk about sabotage than there was actual sabotage. However, there was sabotage, so it's not – I don't want to, you know, cover that up. But what the I think what was new about it was that the environmental movement up to that point, I think, was perceived as weak, was perceived as caving in a lot to the corporations and to the government, and was sort of perceived as, you know, very upper crust, teetotaling, maybe yuppie-ish in its perspective. And what Earth First did, it was
pretty white
and very white. And I'm sorry to say, probably still kind of white to this very day. And those are some issues that still have to be addressed continually until it's rectified. But getting back to the issue of sabotage, I want to say that I think there is no human being in this world who at some point won't physically defend themselves in some manner. If somebody breaks into your house, you have every right to defend yourself against that. And I think what the Earth First movement has seen is that the corporations and the industrial technology have broken into our house being Mother Earth, and are systematically destroying it. There's a line in the movie in which a gentleman says, well, it may be wrong to sabotage equipment, but isn't it equally as wrong to sabotage the environment? So Earth First put this on the table. But of course, and at first, it drew a lot of media attention, and we kind of became the monkey wrench gang, the darlings of the press. Meanwhile, the timber industry was calling us eco-terrorists, but it was a kind of an equal playing field in the media. But then in 1987, a sawmill worker was injured by a tree spike. Now, I can tell you unequivocally that that tree spike was not part of any Earth First action. It was not in a forest that somebody was trying to defend, and the trees were actually very small. However, regardless of the circumstances, it was proven that a human being can be injured. And it was that moment which Judy Barry drew from to renounce the tactic of tree spiking. She said, we can't be alienating workers who are trying to draw to our side, because what she said and what I would say also is that workers and the environmentalists have much more in common with each other than we do with the corporate bosses who are looting the planet and who see the workers just like a tree. It's a resource to exploit. And so she also said very often, not in the movie, but often enough, that if you want to sabotage equipment in the workplace, nobody can do it better than the workers themselves, because they're right there with the machinery. And Judy knew this coming from the union movement when she worked at the bulk mail center in Washington, D.C., and they went on strike. They actually had a wildcat strike with the U.S. Post Office that she was the leader of. They were sabotaging equipment all over the place, and she's featured in a book called Sabotage on the Workplace, and you'll see a chapter called Judy in it, and that was from her work back in the 1970s.
Right, and she was very effective, it seemed, and you all were as a result of kind of getting some of the workers in these logging, you know, some of the loggers on your side. And I'm sure that that was seen as highly dangerous, to have environmentalists and loggers coming together against the company.
Yes, she actually got sawmill workers to wear Earth First shirts inside the sawmills, and that really freaked out the timber companies. And then she'd
I'll bet it did.
Yeah, yes, absolutely, because the ideology of the oppressor is to divide and conquer. And so when you have somebody like Judy bringing everybody together, because she was both a union organizer, a carpenter, a single mom, and a radical environmentalist, when they've got somebody like that bringing people together, that is exactly what literally put a bullseye on her.
Right. And then she took the move of really renouncing that kind of sabotage in terms of tree spiking. And meanwhile, you all were making waves and beginning to have some effectiveness. And of course, the film, for people who haven't seen it and will be looking out for it when it returns to Los Angeles, Who Bombed Judy Barry, not only the story of the bombing itself, but really about the level of organization and the level of impact and success that you had in your organizing. And it was around this time also that threats started coming in. And I wanted to go directly then to the main event. I wanted to play a clip from the film that goes into the, you know, the bombing that took place. And you were in the car, Daryl, and we'll talk a little bit about what that was like. And after you were bombed, you were then accused of trying to basically assassinate yourselves.
Yes.
So let's go to that clip from the film, Who Bombed Judy Berry.
It became much of the focus rather than cutting of the redwoods. It became, are these people terrorists?
Terrorists is all they are. Stinking terrorists.
Why are they terrorists?
Huh? They go blowing up stuff. They caught him down Frisco with the bomb. Yes. Sabotage all the logging equipment.
It took up our whole legal team. It took up much of our key organizers. They were taken up in trying to defend Daryl and me and trying to organize support for me in the hospital and trying to help us with the legal work. So it really took our top leadership out.
What did this make you feel with respect to what had happened?
It made me feel that this was an act of political sabotage aimed at Redwood Summer as much as anything aimed at me or Daryl. People around me tried to put together our own investigative teams because we felt the bombing wasn't being investigated. And I, of course, had to attend these meetings and discuss in great detail all of these things, kind of, you know, dragging it all up. We discussed where did the fake press releases come from and things like that. We just kind of brainstormed to try to figure some of that out.
Did there come a time when you were informed that your house had been searched again?
Yes, that the FBI had researched my house. I knew they said that they were looking for nails. I knew they said that they had found matching nails in my house that they claimed matched nails in the bomb. I knew that this came in the wake of my ex-husband, Mike Sweeney, made a mock-up. He brought this to the press to show that they could show by my injuries that the bomb was under the car seat and not in the back seat. By this time, I was fully aware of those details.
Berry's injuries indicate that the bomb was placed directly underneath her, according to the surgeon who treated her at Highland Hospital, Dr. Peter Slaybaugh.
And when we proved that, the police responded, okay, you're right, the bomb was under the seat, but the nails match.
The search came, I believe, the day after the press conference and subsumed the headlines. One of the headlines said, bomb built at Barry's house, and the contention that I was building bombs in a 600-square-foot cabin while my children were sleeping was very upsetting to me.
And when you have two people doing the noble work that was done by these two who were bombed, be attacked, have their lives threatened, almost killed, then we find we are apparently going to be accused of self-assassination. As we've seen in the operation of our own government, all sorts of acts that make it almost impossible to believe our government. If they can fund death squads in El Salvador, they can fund death squads in the United States.
First of all, we'll talk about the letter, which seems to have changed the focus of the investigation.
The 3-page, single-spaced letter was mailed anonymously to the Santa Rosa Press Democrat. And claims responsibility for placing the bomb in Judy Berry's car. The letter begins, I built with these hands the bomb that I placed in the car of Judy Berry. The letter then goes on to threaten anyone participating in the upcoming Redwood Summer protest by saying, all those who would come to the forest and worship trees like gilded idols have been warned. They have seen the fate that awaits them. It's signed, The Lord's Avenger.
It was scary to me, but it also made me feel exonerated. It made me feel like, well, gee, here's somebody out here confessing. They're not going to blame me for this bombing anymore. And yet they did.
Late today, the FBI admitted it's taking the letter very seriously, although it is not ruled out that it's a prank.
And of course, officials speculate Earth First could have sent the letter to deflect attention from bombing victim Daryl Cherney. He appeared in court Tuesday after Oakland police arrested him for the bombing. But the district attorney refused to press charges.
All we're doing is waiting until we get all of the evidence before us.
In the meantime, Cherney is free on a $100,000 bond. He continues to say he is innocent.
I believe there were 3 court dates in all, and on the third one, the district attorney declined to prosecute for lack of evidence.
criminal charges will not be filed against Earth First organizers Judy Barry and Daryl Cherney.
Flying home from Montana after participating in the annual Earth First encampment, co-defendant Daryl Cherney learned he and Barry would not be charged with transporting the explosives. The district attorney declined today to go on camera to elaborate, but as always, Cherney had plenty to say.
My opinion is that the DA didn't want to go down with the ship that the FBI and the Oakland police were sinking in.
All righty. So that clip, you heard the voice of the late Judy Barry. For people who are not familiar with her story, she survived the attack, went back to becoming an activist, and later died of cancer. Initially, when the bombing happened, the police report claimed that the bomb was in the back seat. Therefore, Judy Barry and Daryl Cherney should have been able to see it. And of course, it was later then proven that the bomb was directly under the seat of Judy Barry. So you heard her testimony, very moving testimony, as she is quite ill there. So this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and I'm talking with Daryl Cherney. You heard him mentioned in that last clip. He was actually arrested and charged with the bombing and freed on a $100,000 bond. But after three court cases, clearly they had nothing to really prosecute for lack of evidence. But Daryl, I can't imagine what that experience was like and what that moment was like. I mean, there you were tooling along in the car, and then suddenly, I mean, do you remember when the explosion happened, or did you just sort of wake up in the hospital, or what was that like?
I never lost consciousness, and it was actually, I was told later that the hump in between the two seats where the transmission is deflected the blast away from me, which is okay. Why I was only slightly injured with some ruptured eardrums and some burns and some scratched cornea, whereas Judy was almost killed with fractured pelvis, dislocated vertebrae. She was impaled on a car seat spring. She had intestinal damage. She was really almost killed. But for me, all I know is I thought I was dead, actually, because I had no frame of reference as to what had just happened. My ears were ringing. I learned later that was my eardrums flapping. The car was bouncing up and down. And then when it came to a sort of a grinding halt, two kids came out of Oakland High, because this happened right in front of Oakland High School.
Oh, my.
On Park and MacArthur. And they came running out going, "It's a bomb. It's a bomb." And that's how I knew, because I didn't had no way of knowing. And the first thing I did was make sure Judy was okay, and she was not okay. And so I kept her talking, and I just kept telling her that I loved her over and over and over again. Then we were dragged out of the car by the paramedics, so I was pulled out, brought to the hospital. Doctor pulled the glass out of my eye, and my left eye patched up, and my right eye was pretty closed. And these two guys in suits walk in and ask me my name. I tell them, and I ask them who they are, and they flop down their badges from their billfolds. And I knew anybody who was stupid enough to show their badges to a blind man had to be the FBI. So, and then they asked me who could have done this, and I sort of rattled off a short list of some people in the industry who I believed were sending us death threats or the fake press releases that were coming out. And they said, "Look, we can tell if this is your bomb, so why don't you just confess, make it easy on all of us, and get it over with?" That was really the third thing they said to me. And, you know, I immediately, my first reaction.
This was that you were still at the hospital?
I was in the emergency room.
In the emergency room this happened.
Yes. And my first thought was really Geronimo Pratt, Gijaga, and Leonard Peltier immediately. That's exactly what I thought of and who I thought of. And I knew immediately what was going on. And that's one of the important reasons why, for young activists in particular, we need to share history.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was reading at the time Ward Churchill's Agents of Repression, which is a history of COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program developed by J. Edgar Hoover and a number of other people, including Richard Held, who was in charge of the San Francisco Bureau of the FBI when we were bombed. So in other words, our case was being overseen by an architect of the counterintelligence program against activists, and we learned that shortly after that.
Yeah, and if you had been in Los Angeles on March 24th, there was actually a teach-in, a sex racing class teach-in, and one of the panelists at that teach-in was Hank Jones from the San Francisco 8. And, of course, the San Francisco 8 former members of the Black Panther Party were also victims of the COINTELPRO operation and still today are still being hounded. So there's quite a history here. So here you are injured. Judy is fighting for her life, basically in hospital, and FBI agents turn up and, you know, accuse you of basically, you know, bombing yourself. Now, at what point did they arrest you?
Well, technically, that was a question in the courtroom when we eventually sued them and took them to trial. Arrest sort of technically means you're not free to leave. And so one could argue we were arrested within 20 minutes of the bomb going off. But certainly I was brought to
– I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But certainly they brought me to a holding cell probably about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And by 11 o'clock at night, they just –
Of what? That same
– That same day.
The same day in the condition that you were in?
Yes. I was brought – and Judy was handcuffed to her hospital bed. She was in the ICU, major surgery. And when she woke up, she was handcuffed to the hospital bed as if she was – and her leg was in traction as if she was going somewhere, you know. So the – in fact, just as a side note, an important side note, not in the movie – the police came and wheeled her out of the ICU, the intensive care unit, without the knowledge of the hospital and put her in the jail ward where the other inmates, women inmates, were actually hitting her up for her drugs, and Judy was out of it. She didn't know what was going on. But back to the moment, it was from 4 to 11. I was in a holding cell without food or water. There was nothing to lie down on. So I took a hard chair, put it on the floor, and rested my head on the back of the chair to give myself a little bit of comfort. I had to bang on the door to get any kind of water or bathroom privileges. And they'd yell at me, and I'd yell right back at them. It was like, you know, they'd tell me to shut up, and I'd say, I don't belong in here. You need to be out there looking for the person who just bombed us. I mean, I wanted to talk to the police because I wanted them to go out and look for the bomber. But I was very rapidly getting the sense that that was not going to happen. When 11 o'clock at night came, they all came in, the FBI and the Oakland police, and started questioning me. They told me that they were going to throw me in jail unless I spoke to them without a lawyer. And I don't recommend anybody else do this.
Threatened you.
But I'm pretty good even after being bombed. I have a good legal head on my shoulders. And I spoke to them for 4 hours, and I spoke intelligently. They actually wrote down that I was trying to convert them to environmentalism during that four-hour period of time.
And this was without a lawyer.
I was without a lawyer.
And something you say you would not suggest.
I don't think anybody else should do that. I might be the exception. And actually turned out to be very good, because when the jury heard that neither one of us were afraid to talk to the police, and here we were, very open. In fact, the next at 3 o'clock in the morning, after them questioning me for 4 hours, they threw me in a holding cell. They said they were going to book me, but they put me in a holding cell with a telephone. Mm-hmm. And so I picked up the phone. There was a dial tone. So I knew every member of the media's number by heart, because I was and am a public relations person. And that was back before cell phones, when you pushed auto dial. And I called KMUD News, a community radio station that airs a lot of Pacifica broadcasting, by the way. Mm-hmm. And I called up KMUD, and they did a live interview from me, which was republished in the New York Times and other places. And called the San Jose Mercury News. I called KPFA and in Berkeley. I called everybody. Now, I would like to think that those are not the actions of a guilty man.
Right. Yeah. Quite something. So at what point, when were you released? And $100,000 bond, quite a lot back then. Still a lot today, but.
Yeah. Yes.
So when did you get out then?
I was released 5 days later when the community did a little hat pass and gathered $10,000, the 10% of the bond, and two of my friends put up their houses as collateral. And it was a Memorial Day weekend, so they may only be allowed to hold you for 48 hours, but on a holiday weekend, you get held extra time. So on Tuesday, we were bombed on a Thursday. So on Tuesday, when I finally got out, I went to court, and they had nothing. The district attorney had no evidence. So we just kept going on for another 6 weeks. Well, they just lied in the press but came up with nothing actually in the courtroom to show we were worthy of indicting. And so that's kind of how it went. And but in the meantime, I think you said something very important earlier, that this is what my experience. But another part of my experience was watching and feeling the woman that I loved. I was in love with Judy Barry for 8 of the 9 years I knew her. I loved her for the entire time I knew her. And to watch one of your loved ones go through that, be shattered, and knowing that you're behind bars and can't do anything about it, and then later on, even afterwards, to watch her suffer for the last 7 years of her life and to feel in my being that there was nothing I could do to alleviate her pain. Yes, I could rub her shoulders. Yes, I could bring her some tea. But there was nothing I could really do was probably one of the most frustrating and agonizing experiences of my life, to feel that helpless.
Yeah, quite something there. Wanting to get a little bit now to perhaps why this was done. I mean, a perpetrator was never found. We're going to get to the case, you know, a little bit later on. But clearly, you and Judy were doing something and were involved in something that some people felt very threatened by. And you were being effective, because they don't feel threatened if you're not being effective. So in addition to bringing the loggers and the activists together, you were in the middle of organizing something called Redwood Summer that was based on a strategy of the civil rights movement, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and others back in the South. And I want to go to another song from the film, and people will be looking out for when this film returns to Los Angeles. Who bombed Judy Barry? And my guest right now is Daryl Cherney, who actually was in the car that was bombed and also helped to produce this film. There is some music from the film about the Freedom Riders and connecting that with Freedom Summer. Let's go to that right now.
He said, "Freedom Riders, all the fires come. Just like in Mississippi, it was done. Well, your forests are a-falling and the nation's eyes must turn. But if you look to Mississippi, there's a lesson you must learn. Call the nation's college students forth, just like when the South called up to the North."
All righty. And Freedom Riders, many people in our audience here at Sojourner Truth likely may know of the history of Freedom Summer, when students came from all across the United States to the South, very much taking their lives at risk. And there were 3 civil rights workers, in fact, who were killed during that time, and many others who were injured. And to this day, the Freedom Singers still sing about the numbers of bodies likely in the Mississippi. But it nevertheless, Freedom Summer was very effective. A lot of students came and were involved in voter registration and doing that kind of work throughout the South. So bringing us back now to this story that the film tells, Who Bombed Judy Barry, here with Daryl Cherney, who was in the car that was bombed, and one of the filmmakers. Tell us about Freedom, about Redwood Summer, and why you based it on Freedom Summer. What was going on?
It's really important for people to understand their history, because we can learn a lot from history, which is, by the way, one of the reasons we made this movie, because we want people to make the connection and draw the lessons from the labor movement to the civil rights movement to the environmental movement, because we're really all sisters and brother movements. And there was actually a man who actually came walking through. His name was Walking Rainbow, as a matter of fact, and he came walking through the Mendocino County and suggested it to Judy.
Suggested Freedom.
He said, "Why don't you draw people from outside the area, just like they did in Freedom Summer in Mississippi, and have them protest for the Redwoods?" he said it perhaps more casually than he I don't think he realized how seriously he was going to take these choice words that he had uttered. But Judy latched right onto them, called me up on the phone and repeated that suggestion. And the words out of my mouth were, "Let's do it." And we started calling meetings, and to it caught on like wildfire. And there was the first chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee really graced us with his presence here in Los Angeles when we did a showing about a month and a half ago. It was a private showing, and I had no idea he was going to come. Charles McDew was his name. And he was here in L.A. not too long ago. Tom Hayden brought him to a screening, and we offered
– I actually remember when he was here with Tom. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he gave a speech, which you can watch – you can see on our Facebook page, Who Bombed Judy Barry. We also have a website, whobombedjudybarry.com. But we have a Facebook page, which you can like, Who Bombed Judy Barry. And that speech that Charles McDew gave is – videotaped and on that website. And this is what he said. He said, "When we started Freedom Summer, yes, we wanted to have civil rights, but we all knew we could be dead in a couple of years. We didn't know if we were going to succeed or we were going to fail, but we knew this, that we were planting seeds." And he said that when he saw our movie, he realized that some of those seeds had sprouted and blossomed into new life. And that was perhaps, I mean, I almost want to cry just thinking about it right now. It was the most moving and beautiful thing that anybody could ever say to me. And in the same way, when Judy and I did Redwood Summer, we were also planting seeds. We wanted people not just to defend the Redwoods, just like when Charles McDew didn't just want people to defend civil rights. We wanted to teach people how to defend themselves.
Right. You know, and I want you to finish that thought, but I really do want to underscore what you're saying, because I do think it is so very important. And Charles McDew is absolutely right. I mean, Goodman, Cheney, Schwerner, you know, killed during that time. My cousin, Martha Prescott, was, you know, down in Mississippi, and they were all, you know, feeling, you know, under threat each and every day. But learning the lessons of the past and building on them for movements right now, I think, are so important, because I think each generation, we think we're really creating something entirely new, that this has never happened before, and get a bit arrogant about it. And therefore, don't look to see what has happened in the past that we can learn from, or perhaps we're even doing the same thing, the same strategies. You know what I mean? So I just think that is so important. And also avoiding the mistakes on the past, when we tried this strategy and this is what happened, and maybe we can do it a little bit differently. So I could understand you being moved when you say you were so moved by what Charles McDew said about SNCC and Freedom Summer, and now Redwood Summer. And now here we have the Occupy movement blossoming and blooming. And we would hope that there would be some time to really, you know, take a look back, because a lot of these tactics and strategies and thoughts were very present in other movements, and people are risking everything, including risking their lives. So Redwood Summer, then, you made a call and people really responded. And were you in the middle of the organizing of Redwood Summer when this horror happened, or give us the time frame here?
Yes. We had actually received probably 36 death threats in a very short period of time, Judy Barry and myself and a few others as well. And we actually tried to accomplish two things at once. We chose to go on a college speaking tour, because just like with Freedom Summer in Mississippi, we wanted to draw from the college students. And so I organized a 15-stop free concert where Judy and I played guitar and fiddle and sang, and Judy gave speeches. I had a slideshow. And so we were able to organize, but at the same time, we felt like we needed to get out of town for a few weeks, because the threats were pretty unnerving. So we could get out of town but still be working. And that was kind of the idea. And, you know, just like – so the lessons we were drawing from Freedom Summer were, one, organize college kids, bring them here. Secondly, that the eyes of the nation, when you look behind the Redwood Curtain, just like when you look behind the Deep South and the Jim Crow laws and all that, the rest of the country was shocked. And with us, it was the same thing. You look at the Redwoods being slaughtered. It's not that the issues are identical in their dynamic, but there's certain overriding principles that are unify all these issues. So we went out, and I mean, people were just coming, and we were thousands of people were going to come and did come. We were on the front pages of many of the mainstream newspapers. So
I remember that.
Yes, and so we were on a roadshow organizing kids, and we thought when we were in Oakland that morning, just before 12 noon, that we were safe. That we weren't – that no logger or mill worker or crazy person was going to shoot us, because we thought if somebody was going to try to kill us, they'd use a gun. That's kind of the American way, you know. Believe it or not, you know, there aren't that many bombings, assassination attempts in this country that maybe you see them in Colombia or Italy or, you know, now in the Middle East, but not here in the United States, at least not then and not even really now. So – when we got in that car, yes, we were on an organizing roadshow, and that was the context in which it happened.
Yeah. So and the full Redwood summer had not yet happened, but you were in the middle of organizing for it. And clearly, I remember when it was happening, it was getting a lot of national press, and it really, you know, put the movement front and center in a way that was perhaps too much for some people to bear. I wanted now to move on to because the bombing did happen, the perpetrator was never found, but you all went ahead and pressed charges. And I wanted to go to a clip now that would go into a bit of that lawsuit and what happened.
Ultimately, you started this lawsuit, correct?
No. Daryl started this lawsuit. I was still too disabled to deal with lawsuits.
And did you want it to start?
Absolutely.
What was it your hope to achieve by pursuing the lawsuit?
Justice.
In what form?
Justice and vindication. The other purpose was to try to create some kind of restraint on the FBI so that they couldn't continue to do this to political activists.
We've charged them with false arrest, illegal search and seizure, unequal protection of the law, and conspiracy to violate our First Amendment rights by discrediting us as terrorists.
And have there been things that you've learned in the course of the lawsuit that have had an effect on you that added on to the impact of the original arrest and the accusations?
The discovery that the FBI had held a bomb school in Eureka, California, 1 month before I was bombed, during which they blew up cars with pipe bombs. In discovery, when Hansen said that there had been this bomb school and that Frank Doyle had been his instructor, and that what they had done practically recreated the same crime scene, the way I heard it. As soon as we walked out of that deposition, I was terrified. I had panic attacks. I was terrified.
Did you know at that time that the FBI was involved in the case?
Absolutely. But even more, I learned that Richard Held was in charge of the San Francisco FBI. I didn't know who he was before that. And I knew that he was making statements in the newspapers about the case.
We have to go where the evidence goes. As an investigative agency, we collect whatever evidence is available and take it to the U.S. Attorney's office to determine if there's a basis for prosecution.
Did you learn some alleged facts about Richard Held that you connected to the status of your own case?
Yes. I was brought articles detailing Richard Held's career in the FBI, and I learned that he was a COINTELPRO operative under J. Edgar Hoover.
The decline in Hoover's reputation began soon after his death in 1972, as the nation began to learn the full extent of his abuse of power, his his persecution of Martin Luther King and other civil rights leaders, of feminists and the early environmentalists.
J. Edgar Hoover described it as a way of targeting domestic radical groups that they think are a threat to the U.S. government. And these are his words: to expose, misdirect, isolate, and neutralize political groups that he didn't like. And that's really what's been done to Earth First.
They used the term neutralize, but no one ever defined what neutralize meant. You know, someone might think, well, gee, why don't I just have one of my informants in another organization go out and shoot this guy and, you know, have him assassinated. That'll neutralize him for sure.
And those things are what made me sure that when, despite my innocence, I could still spend my life in prison, because I felt that this man had a track record.
Special Agent Richard Held is the man behind the show. He helped frame Leonard Peltier and jab Geronimo. He falsified the evidence by sentences, no bail.
Wow, what an amazing, amazing story, the film, Who Bombed Judy Barry. She is not with us, died of cancer before she was able to see justice in the courts. But clearly her work and the work of people like Daryl Cherney and so many of those activists continue. We literally just have a couple of minutes, Daryl, and I just wanted to give you the opportunity to make some final comments.
Let's change the way we think about each other and our relationship to the planet, and then we're going to see a world that will go on for a long time for all of us.
Well, on that note, Daryl Cherney, producer of the film Who Bombed Judy Barry, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you, and whobombedjudybarry.com for our schedule.
We are out of time. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I would like to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team, Teresa McGee, Azim Khan, Eric Doyle, Sammy Mangello, and of course, Mr. T. Teddy Robinson, our engineer and assistant producer, Sarah Shakur. I would love to hear from you. You could email me directly at mpkpfk@gmail.com. If you'd like copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. You can follow us on Twitter at SoTrueKPFK and look for us on Facebook. Look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. Stay tuned for Uprising. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air on Tuesday morning with a special edition. Thank you so very much for listening. I hope you get to do something really nice this weekend.
If they could, they would take them all. And that's why Babylon must fall. 'Cause Babylon the Great, it will collapse under its own weight. Just a few thousand acres left, but they're not protected from theft by the Maxim Company.